So, Bob, if you can stop chuckling as you have been off mic about
free game giggles. I know I'm going to whoop your asses, man. This is going to be good.
Okay, well, Bob's been... I have to inform our listeners that Bob Dobbs here has been chuckling off mic about the very idea that his argument could have anything to do with those of Martin Heidegger. And the person who's floating these ideas is Michael Tenser, currently in Melbourne, Australia. And Michael's joining us for this show, so it's a slightly unusual Bob and Ben show. In fact, it should be renamed the Bob and Ben and Michael show. So, but we chatted a little bit before this all started, and we agreed that I should begin in the usual way by asking Bob what's been on his mind lately. Bob, what's been on your mind lately?
Michael's been on my mind because I was informed that he'd be on this week. And then I became a Facebook buddy of his in there, and he sent me something, but I haven't looked at it yet. And I just been wondering about that.
Bob, do you feel you've been stalked?
No. I'm interested. I heard the Michael Ben dialogue, and I know that Michael has no affinity for McLuhan or what he thinks McLuhan is, and he's out to make sure that doesn't enter his meme. So I regard Michael as Ben too, another Ben who is not going to learn from McLuhan, but will be suitably impressed a little bit as they learn more through me, but will not give in. You've lived too long, you guys. You will not change.
How do you feel about people popping up who've been listening to what we do? And we're now in the 16th hour of our dialogues. And as you were saying, it seems to open up more questions than we ever solve, which is why we keep doing it. But there aren't that many people who trace them and then say they want to get involved. So when, you see, we are discussing the ideas of Karl Marx and Marshall McLuhan over the oeuvre of Frank Zappa. And one of the frustrations that me and my original Frank Zappa fans always had was there was Frank Zappa doing his shows. There was us responding. And how do we get him to listen to us? That was the whole question. That was the whole project that me and Danny Houston began back in the mid-70s, was how do we get him to listen to us? We wanted it all to go the other way. We didn't want to just hear Frank Zappa. We wanted him to hear us. So how do you feel about someone popping in who's not just listening to us, but wanting us to hear them?
Well, I understand the feeling, but I've always had Frank's ear and had an influence on him. I've known him since 1958, so I understood and saw it, and people who knew I knew Frank tried to get to Frank through me, but I certainly understood that frustration.
In some ways, Bob, it's important for you to talk to me, because you can't really understand the importance of Frank if you are part of the court circle. That Frank's oeuvre is best situated, best understood from the point of view of exclusion, because it's a commentary on alienation and the product and the way in which we have fantasies about commercial commodities that we purchase, and yet we're not having an influence on them. It's a discussion about it. So it seems to me it's more profound to start from an area where you don't know Frank than being involved with the court circle and giving us what Frank himself called biographical trivia. I mean, he was very polemical about that on his very first album, on Freak Out. He called it biographical trivia when he told us about his everyday life. And I think what he meant then was he was more interested in someone who knew nothing about him responding to his art as an objective thing. Don't you think that having an involvement with Frank from the inside can actually prevent you having an objective view of what the art means?
Well, I have the perfect alibi to show that I was not subject to that syndrome. I hung out with Jerry Fialka. Okay?
Now, so as long as you hang out with Jerry Fialka, you're obviously hanging out with an absolute outsider loser who can't understand anything and has the obdurate response to everything, which is immediate and childlike, and therefore is a kind of touchstone for how this stuff is really working. Is that what you mean?
Exactly. And he's the one who turned me on to you. I mean, you showed up while writing the book, and I'm sure he told me about you.
And we have established by sending agents to his home in Los Angeles that his interior decor was the exact replica of Danny Houston's in Ealing in London. And therefore, those two people, for us, have been exactly the same. They have been the fan who is needing to build up some kind of warfare or some kind of collection versus this imposition that they've received, that they understand the hurt involved with what being a star under this system does to you, and they started some kind of counterattack, which we want to pursue with maybe more grand intellectual tools, but we understand where it comes from, and we're a little bit like that ourselves. Would that fit with your relationship with Jerry?
Exactly. And I mean, Esimplasm began, you could say, there, because Jerry was the fulcrum. Then you have your Danny, and I have Jerry. It was inevitable that we get together. And then when I read your book, geez, the guy talked about Wyndham Lewis and James Joyce. That was shocking. But see, Jerry wouldn't have known, understood that. He could have told me. I don't even know if he read your book. But the thing is it took me to read your book to discover that. He should have told me that stuff. Would have happened faster. So, yeah, look, the point is Frank and I had an ongoing argument, you know, and I was not a problem for him like David Wally was. I mean, David Wally is who he's referring to in the liner notes to Grandma Zoo, where he says the court, the biographer, right, sitting at the table with Cletus Auritus?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not the hot girl who likes to get flogged called Trivia. Well, what is the biographer called? No, I can't remember.
You can't remember. But the thing is that the very last line in Zappa's autobiography about the higher form of killing, I'm the one who gave him that information.
Yeah, you have mentioned that on this show already.
Yeah.
Now, I'd like to position Michael, who's listening to this, and are you still there, Michael, or have you got bored and turned off?
Yeah, I do.
Right, good. Where do you think you sit? I mean, do you understand what we're talking about in terms of these alter ego Frank Zappa friends who approach Frank Zappa in a different way and yet open up a whole lot to us and kind of challenge our intellectual way of understanding things? I'm not asking you if you've got one, but I mean, you're of a different generation, so maybe you don't need these things, but I'm just interested to know, does that ring a bell with you or correspond to anything in your experience, or is it just kind of the wild lunatic imaginings of older people?
No, I definitely I understand where you're coming from with that. It's a little different for me because I unfortunately only got into Frank Zappa at a time when he was either just about to die or was already dead. So because I'm younger, I wasn't able to even have the option to, for instance, see Frank in concert, much less respond to him.
So you never imagined getting admittance to the court circle because it's the whole oeuvre is already finished when you start.
Yeah, well, it was already impossible in my case. But once I started getting into the music, I of course wished that I could have. It would have been quite nice to ask a few questions, but that was impossible.
So Ben, I'll just say yes. So I having done many phone calls or talk shows with calls coming in, I want people to challenge me or come in. So I'm all for Michael or whatever he represents coming in, the street or whatever. So, no, I didn't say that. That was what your original question was.
But I feel in a way that we're behaving a little like the greatest improvising group that's ever existed in the UK, which is Hessian Wilkinson Fell, Paul Hessian, Alan Wilkinson and Simon Fell. And I put them together with an American guitarist called
Joe
Morris. And they responded by their very first gig. They played really hard and loud in order to prevent him coming in. And he was there with his guitar and looking for ways into the music. And I could see what they were doing. They were absolutely like, what's Ben doing? He's got this grant to get this tour, get this guitarist in. Why are we here? We are keeping him out. And I feel in a way that the way Bob and me were talking just then might have appeared a little bit like that, that me and Bob were talking about this and that, and it gave no room for Michael, because we can talk this stuff for hours on end, as we were talking about earlier, Bob, that it just seems infinite how we can find in each other's ideas something always to say, and the subject seems to expand each time we try and talk about it. But the reason I wanted to get Michael involved was actually an indignation that he had about hearing us talk. So I want to ask Michael quite directly, is quite apart from issues of audiences becoming vocal and heckling and wanting to get involved and those issues, what is your gripe? Why do you want to intervene? Michael, why do you want to put your oar in?
Well, there are a couple of things that I think are unanswered questions in the discussions that you guys have been having. And I think that you'd be able to, or we all would be able to work them through, because I couldn't ask this to anybody else.
Yes, I realized I did read your note on Ben and I, and yes, alchemy and other things are all relevant. Falconelli, I mean, Zappa was impressed with Falconelli. So I'm just reminding you of your note, multiplicious. You like Ben's use of multiplicious. We're the only ones who can talk to you about what you lay out in this note to us.
Right.
So go ahead with what aspect of it you want. Tactility, your problem with tactility.
Well, we are the only three people who can talk to each other. It's just the problem is that we haven't yet found a way of talking so far. I mean, I'm burning to get this discussion on the road, but I still feel this stiltedness and this problems of getting back to swapping trivia about Frank Zappa, which kind of produces a kind of nausea in my bloodstream when I'm doing it. You know, that is not what I'm here for or what I want to do or I've ever wanted to do, and yet I'm sort of back in this morass of Zappa fandom, and that's not what I expect from people who I can really communicate with, which I agree, Michael. I mean, you and Bob are the two people I can talk to, but we're talking nonsense. And Michael, maybe you can save us. Let's get down to it. Michael, talk.
This is our first show. We're starting. No references to Apple McLuhan Marks. Let's just see what happens. Go ahead, Michael.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I'm going to quote back to you stuff you said in last week.
Save us, Michael.
okay, well, the first thing that I wanted to ask you guys is some stuff about McLuhan, actually, because I've been reading some McLuhan, and I think I'm finding, first of all, surprisingly, McLuhan isn't completely wrong, as I thought, but on the other hand, I do find certain things that he's saying completely miss the mark in terms of the main influences. He's saying, for instance, media, the form of the media, is what is is what is determining the social reaction to it, or the psychic reaction to it. Let me talk about you guys first before I talk about McLuhan, so that.
Yeah, I'm much more interested in us than McLuhan, so carry on. I like this.
So, in your 14th show, around 17 minutes and 25 seconds... Bob, you say that McLuhan felt that human nature was changed by technology. And my question to you is there such a thing as human nature? And is it closer... Is that statement closer to arguing a change in the zeitgeist or a change in the collective unconscious?
Those are hard questions. You have to acknowledge that McLuhan didn't mean, he was not proposing a theory. He was trying to be as obnoxious as possible, what he called being a Manippean satirist. So he was in the 60s presented as a sociologist with a new explanation of human culture. And when you got to know him, he really was not on that level.
In fact, Bob, what you're arguing for is Marshall McLuhan as Frank Zappa. You're saying his truth is in his provocations, in his obnoxiousness.
Yeah, in the Joyce and Lewis tradition, the vortices tradition. Zappa and McLuhan were vortices. Yeah, but what was interesting about McLuhan, he did build on knowledge coming out of Harold Innes and other people. There was no doubt people like Jacques Ellul, you know, the French philosopher, who said that the propaganda was not the messages in the culture, it was the constant massage by media that was propaganda. And he found other thinkers that were starting to see the medium as was the message, or there was a new meme. There's now a media ecology association that builds on that. But McLuhan said, okay, you guys are starting to develop this new serious scholarship about that possibility that form does this. Well, I'm going to take that idea and push it to extreme, to challenge you people. So he actually was the outsider of the new thesis that form was a big influence on human nature. That's what's interesting about McLuhan. You could say that about Zappa.
And Michael, you actually agree with this idea, because we both agree that when you're in a particular situation of reception of cultural stuff, that the very organization of it is really what everybody's doing. So the little bit of decorative, you know, kind of filigree that someone's producing at the front really doesn't matter at all to these people, because it's merely enabling the whole situation to turn round. Now, you would agree with that. As a obnoxious revolutionary avant-gardist, you know that totally. That's absolutely what you hate. So Bob's explaining to us that Marshall McLuhan's The Medium is the Message is part of that argument. It's part of saying, don't you realise that it's not about getting a good TV programme on? TV in itself is doing something to everybody, that maybe you'd like, what we should be doing is something which is not TV, that maybe takes that technology and uses it in a different way, or, you know, that we have to think about the mechanisms of transference of these ideas from one person to another, and that might enable us to do something better.
Yeah, well, and he took the broad... go ahead.
Different minds about this, actually. I feel, like, for instance, I weirdly enough, totally agree with Bob's take on Marshall McLuhan. From reading Understanding Media, you really get the sense of Marshall McLuhan as a kind of 50s ad man. He's sort of like what Vance Packard was writing about in The Hidden Persuaders. I could actually read it as Menippean satire, because I'm not a huge fan of everything that he's writing about, but I really enjoy the form, weirdly enough. But at the same time, there's still a lot to be said for content. I mean, when Frank was a child and he's looking at scores of classical music and he sees the notes of the harp and he loves the way that the harp notes are drawn, you know, that might be what Ben was referring to before as something ornamental, which doesn't really matter in the midst of this form of the written score of classical music. But yet, it's absolutely essential, because if Frank hadn't seen that, you know what I mean?
So just to say, if Frank is looking at the score for a harp piece, he's merely locked into a bourgeois way of putting time into space in a linear way. He's merely locked into that, which is what a lot of the sound art people argue about the whole of the Western tradition of music. That kind of cheap way of getting rid of tradition would be, for me, completely wrong. And therefore, what I was arguing for before about the medium is the message will become something I completely oppose. And I agree with you, Michael, about saying, no, within certain frames, a thing can be presented which might be the absolute essential small interruptions of this dot and that dot which you need for your psyche to orient itself according to the world as it exists. And this very, very specific thing cannot be dissociated from the frame that allows you to look at it. So on the other hand, we need the medium is the message as a basic critical idea, but we also need absolute valuement of your response to what happens within the frame, if it really matters.
Yes.
But this isn't a complete contradiction. Without dialectics, we can't understand what we're thinking about, because we're not deciding on one or the other, are we? We're not deciding on the frame. You know, the frame's important, or the substance is important. We're trying to run away from it. But I think all three of us just can't stand the choice.
Yeah. Well, that was my mistake, I think, with looking at McLuhan. I thought that McLuhan was misunderstanding, was simply taking the... seeing... what do you say? Taking the map for the territory and saying the only thing that is important is the media.
Yeah.
And of course that's wrong, because, you totally misunderstand political and social causes of events if you think it's only the media that influences them.
You know, in some ways, I think you only understand social and political causes because you actually remove the subjective. Maybe the subjective is a thing which is in the frame, that the sociological and political interpretation of everything, which is historically from the revolutions of the 1960s through to now, have got ensconced in academia in the wrong way. I've got to a point where I've lost my thread.
Well, can I pick it up?
Yes, please.
Okay, well, I'm going to give a quote from Marshall McLuhan from Understanding Media, page 27. He says, he's talking about the twist.
Oh, we're talking about the dance here.
This is a good example. The dance, the twist, yeah. And he's talking about the twist versus the Charleston, and why the twist as a medium was not acceptable in Russia in the 1960s, whereas the Charleston was. And I think he's wrong about this, but okay. He says, in the special Russian issue of Life magazine for September 13th, 1963, it is mentioned in Russian restaurants and nightclubs, though the Charleston is tolerated, the twist is taboo. All this is to say that a country in the process of industrialization is inclined to regard hot jazz as consistent with its development programs. The cool and involved form of the twist, on the other hand, would strike such a culture at once as retrograde and incompatible with its new mechanical stress.
Mm-hmm. Well, I can understand
that. Wrong way of looking at it.
No, but isn't that actually why Soviet Russia at that point suppressed the 60s subjectivism is because they didn't allow the gap between the subjective and the objective, because they thought they'd solved it. They thought it was socialism. Of course, we know it was state capitalism, but people thought it was socialism. Therefore, you couldn't have something that was totally involved with yourself, that was against everything, because if you were against everything, you couldn't be right. You know, you couldn't be right. Whereas capitalism tells us all the time that every twist you do is right. The only problem is it's powerless.
But that's... I think that he was... I think Marshall McLuhan is wrong about seeing the twist as inherently subversive. I think that it's only subversive in relation to that context and in that period in time.
Of course, but but there is nothing inherently subversive. I mean, this is the old problem of, can you produce an unrecuperable artwork? There is nothing inherently subversive. Everything is used in particular moments. There is no essence.
But that's why the view of the medium as the message would be wrong in this context. It's like saying Falun Gong is inherently subversive. Well, there's nothing inherently subversive about the form of people moving around in that way. It's just in relation to what the prevailing government and what the situation politically is.
I agree with that in thinking about things, dances in relation to politics. I mean, that's correct. I still have another set of thoughts about that, which is, and I think you agree with this, Michael, so you'll have to wrestle with it in your own head, which is that the artwork is essentially objective. That I don't think everything is contingent or merely an instant in a process and can be totally reversed. I don't believe in the production of unrecuperable artworks, that ideology, the idea of trying to produce something you can sell, which will always be resistant to selling. I think that's ridiculous and impossible. But the idea that everything should be reduced to can only be understood in terms of context implies that understanding the context stands above the context. And that can't be true, because we are people living in society trying to understand it. And so what is this understanding of the context which is somehow beyond the context? So one just caught by a philosophical problem there.
Well, the universal is in the particular. this came up a few shows ago for you guys. You're saying, is the universal strictly an oppressive concept, or is there truly a possibility for the universal which isn't oppressive? And I think that there is a non-oppressive universality, which is the particular. The closer that you get to the most trivial, mundane, obscure kind of surrealist little objects in this popular culture, or whatever, the closer you get to the universal.
And I'm interested to know what Bob thinks about this topic.
A lot of things. First of all, I guess I look at McLuhan, when I interpret McLuhan, I'm looking at the form of McLuhan, not the content. So Michael is citing a particular content. Michael, did you know?
Okay, I've got it, Bob. Phrase. I've suddenly got it when you said that. You interpret Marshall McLuhan as an artist. You don't interpret him as a social theorist or a philosopher or a economist. You interpret him as an artist. You've been affected by him artistically. He gives you a kick.
Yes, and some of the McLuhan scholars have now caught on to that. There's a new book by Richard Cavell, McLuhan in Space, where he talks about McLuhan's immense influence in the art world all around the planet, and which no scholar had ever done before, because they thought he was a sociologist or a futurist or a lackey of General Motors or General Electric. They didn't know. When you met McLuhan, you understood he was an artist, but it was a new kind of artist. That's interesting.
Okay, but Bob, to get you back, unless you've lost the thread,
can I go back to Michael's
quote? It's back to the particular, yeah?
Yeah, see, that's what's interesting. This is why we don't stay on point, because we're talking things that inspire all kinds of ideas, which are interesting and fascinating, so we spiral off, so that's good. But we've been doing this for 15 hours, so we will try not to spiral off and stay on point, whatever that point is. Okay, you're reading Understanding Media. The main slogan that comes out of that, in an ad lingo world, is the medium is the message. Did you know that McLuhan produced another slogan in the 70s?
Which, the medium is the massage?
Yeah, to be the opposite. I have mentioned it on this show occasionally. It's called, it's the statement, the user is the content.
Oh, yeah.
You remember? Okay, so he writes in his letters, right when he's starting to talk about the users of the content in 70 and 71, he doesn't want to be the 60s McLuhan anymore. He says, when I wrote Understanding Media and these other early books and talked about the media's message, I forgot to mention that the user is the content.
Now, the way that I interpret that, Michael, if I can just put a footnote or a gloss on what Bob's saying, the way I interpret, you know, because Bob said this to me before about the user being the content, is it fits to me with my idea that the artwork should be an objective thing, and the really exciting stuff is us thinking about it. The one thing I hate is biographical trivia, you know, the way that people interpret artworks by turning artists into stars. So we get interested in who Picasso married. I'm not interested in that. I'm interested in, if I see a Picasso painting, does it turn me on or not? What it does to my head? In which case, maybe that Marshall McLuhan slogan fits. In which case, the real content of a Picasso painting is my response to it. So it puts it back in my head. So it's not a matter of projecting Picasso to the skies and being totally interested in everything he did and, you know, sort of worshipping him. It's an idea that the real point is my response. That's really what matters. My problem with the user is the content, is that it goes so against the usual terms, you know, that content is usually set against form, the usual rational ways of dealing with words, that I find Marshall McLuhan quite clumsy in that formulation. That in arguing with Bob, I kind of worked out an interpretation which suits me of that idea, but I don't particularly like that way of putting it, because it jars with the rest of the way language seems to be used. But
well, it's advertising language.
Yeah, he's miming this. He considered advertising as the major art form of the 20th century, and so he was going to be an anti-environment, an artist in relation to that quote fact. So yes, he took on the aspect of advertising,
and I think that it is extremely similar to what Frank was doing when he pissed off Paul McCartney for refusing to call records anything other than product.
That's right. Frank and Warhol came out of ad agencies, and McLuhan was an expert on that.
And so I do understand McLuhan in those terms. I can actually see him as an artist rather than a sociologist, because but see, at the same time,
but if he's not an artist, what is he adding to advertising? What's the difference between...
Well, it's not so much...
You know, between... I mean, Bob's laid out that they come from advertising, but if they come from it, where are they going to? What's the resistance? Why don't they just become good advertisers? This is where I'd load in class conflict, criticism and capitalism and a huge political agenda, which I think is in... I can see in Frank Zappa. I don't think it's there in Warhol, actually. But... what is the, you know, if you come from advertising and that explains it, Bob, you seem so pleased to say, well, they come from advertising, that explains it. But why, what's the difference between them and advertising? Are they totally against advertising, or are they a special added little icing, you know, like nice little icing on advertising, a kind of artistic, theoretical, little bit better on top of advertising? Or, you know, how do they stand in relation to advertising? They come from advertising, they understand it, but what's this extra thing they want to do, Bob?
They have a grievance against advertising. You see, McLuhan and Zappa were fortunate by looking at advertising before the average consumer, the average bear was. And so they had an inside, they defected from their inside information. So Zappa knew what he was up against. McLuhan presents a more complex understanding of what advertising is. And that's why Jerry Fiocco said to me when he read Mechanical Bride, this is way more profound than Zappa. And he'd been impressed with Zappa at that point. But I'm just saying advertising was the language you had to become aware of. And in late 50s, early 60s, people weren't that sophisticated. They read Vance Packard. And Frank talks about Vance Packard, I think, in the Bob Marshall interview. But Frank knew it was more complex than Vance Packard laid out, and McLuhan doubled that. So actually, I think Frank and McLuhan were arguing with Vance Packard.
Well, indisputably. I mean, who can argue with that? But that's not quite what we were thinking about.
I know. Okay, sorry to take it that way. They were angry. Zappa and McLuhan did not like this new language of advertising fooling people.
Yeah.
Because they weren't.
Yeah. I think that's, we need to sound that ground bass, you know. And for Frank, I think it was R&B. It was black popular music represented to him a truth which was not being recognized by the ad world. So that was his weapon against it. That was his anchor, you know. He was not postmodern in that sense of we have no anchors, we drift anywhere. That Frank was really not postmodern in that sense, that he thought R&B really said the truth. It said the truth about people's relationships and sex, and, you know, was something that was healthy for people just to hear. It was like going and watching a rabbit being cut up on a butcher's slab. You know, this is an animal. This is how you take the skin off. This is actually how it is. He felt that the R&B, the popular black music that was around in the 50s when he was listening to radio, had that quality of reality. And that's an anti-postmodern argument, isn't it? I mean, that's it believes in some relationship to a truth. And that gave Frank his you know, if you're wrestling, you need to have your heel, you know, kind of on the ground, you know, because if you haven't got that, you can't have got no what's the word, you know, no angle, no spring,
balls, no
you've got no
fulcrum, balls, no
fulcrum. No, what is it? It's not fulcrum, that's gravity. Anyway, you can't win.
so
yeah. And so Frank had that in that music. That's where he experienced his toe to the ground, you know, because then he could battle all this stuff like advertising. So this is for now discussion. I'm completely interested in all aspects of what is being done to us. But the problem is that you get into these two camps. Some people say, well, I don't want to listen to all that stuff or hear about it because I'm pure and I'm over here in the art camp. And then you have the other people who say, well, no, we're experts in the how to manipulate the media. And I find myself very torn because I have my foot in something I really like, but the only place I want my head to be in is what everyday experience is. I'm not interested in sliding off and being an aesthetic person. I want to know all the rubbish that's being thrown at us all the time, because that's experience in the modern world. I mean, you know, who would want to experience anything else? You know, it's to hide yourself and read E.M. Forster. It's ridiculous.
Okay, I got something to say. Do you want to say something, Michael?
I would just say that I think that they're satirists. I can understand Marshall McLuhan as a satirist as much as I can understand Frank as a satirist of media and advertising. And I think that if they weren't satirists, you'd know it, because advertising ultimately makes us into anxious money.
Right.
And I don't feel that way about...
Michael, I want to ask you a specific question.
No, wait, Ben, let me respond to this.
Okay, Bob, go ahead. Sorry.
The dialectic, the tactile interplay of the philosophical conundrum you said earlier, of yourself between the seats and head, that is totally what McLuhan is conscious of, and Zappa maybe instinctively. Look at the different statements. Zappa, in Newsweek in 1968, when the pressure's on him to produce a social agenda, because he's the leader of the counterculture, he says, well, I'm just raising questions. He didn't want to give any answer. Another, McLuhan said that he had the questions, and 20th Century Man didn't know what the questions are. Two parallel,
Bob,
similar statements.
Aren't you frightened that you may be just finding the parallel arguments of people who really don't know much and use a kind of cheap way out and comparing it and then finding it cosmically fantastic that these two people should use the same evasive set of terms? I mean, I don't...
I haven't even begun. Okay.
Well, yeah, but I mean, I don't find it, you know, inspiring when you say that. I find it a bit depressing.
Well, because you didn't hear it all. I'll make it inspiring. Listen to this. Part two. Who are the brain police? Same question that McLuhan raised. Okay. The point is, they both were in the middle, juggling both sides.
Well, give me the quote from McLuhan where he's talking about the brain police.
the television is television is an extension of the central nervous system and numbs the central nervous system. That is a larger brain release than the one that Zappa was talking about. But note that Zappa would not answer.
That sounds like Dasein.
Yeah.
What?
Well, so what? Hey, have you read McLuhan on...
Look,
on,
Martin on Heidegger Hitler? Has raised his Nazi head. What's going on, man? What's happened to my program?
Like Wyndham Lewis.
Yeah. Did you know that McLuhan wrote on Heidegger?
Did he really?
No, yes. I haven't read that.
Okay. Two quotes.
Where?
In Gutenberg Galaxy, he has a book with many little headlines, and one of the headlines is, just as Descartes surfed the print effect, Heidegger surfs the electronic effect. That's one quote.
Wrong.
That's right. They are effects, and McLuhan is not agreeing with him. He's just saying they're figures for the brain police that neither Descartes or Heidegger understood. They're surface figures. The next, in Laws of Media, in his final book, he says that Heidegger moved from concept to percept. That would be your Dasein, existentialism, whatever you want to say. And McLuhan is saying Heidegger doesn't know why he was forced to move to percept.
So I've got to object. I can't stand it any longer, Bob. There you are in Maui with your surfing positivistic, you know, like wealthy American attitude about everything. Like if you're surfing it, it's great. Descartes,
I didn't say it was great. He's criticizing.
Well, is he right? But is he correctly criticizing? I mean, let's take Descartes. What is wrong with Descartes? Why do we disagree with Descartes? I disagree with Descartes.
He splits the mind and the body.
He splits the mind and the body. He is the entry.
He's
the carrying
the
on of the Christian metaphysic and Christian dualism between the soul and the body into science. I will, of course, admit that Descartes invented the most fantastic or formalized the most fantastic practical way of testing everything, which everybody has adopted and is called science, and Descartes did that. But he smuggled in a metaphysic of a separation of the soul and the body, a religious idea, which is, you know, it has been taken up by the class system that we live under and oppresses us. And so to say that Descartes is a response to print, Heidegger is a response to electronic media, these superficial statements about a philosopher and their time, which is all it is with McLuhan, doesn't take a critical relation to the writer themselves and think about who's criticised them. I mean, if McLuhan said, well, Herman Samuel Reimarus has great pages attacking Descartes, particularly about animals, or that Giambattista Vico has great pages attacking Descartes on his dismissal of history, then we would have somebody with real knowledge of who these great philosophers are and how criticisms of them have been forgotten because of the fact that we live under a system which is maintaining a Christian metaphysic because it suits the powers that be and holding back all sorts of possibilities that exist with reason in our society. That McLuhan says to me, like, he is what Du Bois said, he's the greatest imbecile of the 20th century. That he's pretending to say profound things about Descartes and Heidegger, but he's not getting to the point. I can get to the point.
See, Ben,
well, I can't because it's just a response to print.
You, again, this show is just me talking to myself. You cite the very things that McLuhan does. The headline is the headline of a chapter. Then inside it, he quotes Vico and a lot of other scholars of Descartes' day critiquing Descartes. The very thing you say McLuhan didn't do, he does.
Well, he doesn't.
But you haven't read the books. You don't know he did it.
Yeah, okay. But until I mention that, I don't hear it. Because what I hear is from you that there's these eras of humanity. One is to do with print, next with electronics. And so Descartes can rule over the print era, and Heidegger can rule over the electronic era.
They're dupes. They're dupes of the electronic era.
But,
or the print. They're dupes.
Yeah, well, you're saying
they're
dupes now.
They're dupes.
But I'm worried, Bob, that if it wasn't me talking to you, if I hadn't introduced that, you would carry on with your, you wouldn't have revealed this stuff about McLuhan. It's only by me pummeling you for something a little more concrete, something a little bit more true, a bit more critical, that I find out, you know, it's like I've got to, like, strangle you in a dream and I'm twisting you and then there's this trickle of blood comes out and it's actually true, but it's an effort, Bob.
Ben, I wouldn't ask you to listen to the 25 years of stuff on my timeline. I do the show in my sleep because I have explained in detail these things for many times, many shows for years. You just haven't heard them.
Yeah, well, so, I can't sit around listening to your shows, Bob.
If you had kept quiet during the first 15 hours and let me dominate, you get a lot of this stuff out. But you go on and fill in the other part that I intended to say, and so it ends up me talking to myself. But I don't mind it, Ben.
You shouldn't mind it, because in this confusion, we are actually throwing around the materials we've mastered and knocking it around to produce an image of how we think things actually are that we look at. That all this stuff is not really soluble by some kind of scholarly treatment, because scholars will go out and they can mount up arguments this way and that way about McLuhan and who said and, you know, all the rest of it. We're dealing with an expressive urge, aren't we? We're dealing with a need to say or to situate ourselves, orient ourselves according to what's going on at the moment and how we feel about it.
And notice how difficult it is.
Yeah. And we're drawn to talking to each other because we think we could help each other orient ourselves towards that. Yeah?
Yes.
So that's actually what we're doing. It's not really amount of, what's actually... I mean, all information is... I'm grateful for all information, and, you know, I like to learn that already McLuhan has anticipated the ideas I'm having, and, you know, that's great. But the reason we're talking is not really to digest McLuhan and get the end result. It's to orient ourselves, isn't it? And hopefully orient people who are listening to us having this conversation.
That's what we attempted 20 minutes ago. Yes, I'm just saying, 20 minutes ago we said, let's try not to refer to these people. And we opened it to Michael. Michael quotes McLuhan.
Well, yeah, that was his way in.
that's where we went on.
So come on.
Start again.
Well, let's let Michael come steaming in with no quote from anybody. How do you feel, Michael? Are you having a good time?
Yeah, I'm having a great time. I hope I get to do this again.
No problem. I welcome many voices.
Well, let me ask you guys a question. Because... okay, let's put aside all the different names and stuff, and let's just get to what I think is the central question in all of this, which is, coming again from Hermeticism, is there a great mystery? Is there something that we can find out as initiates that will somehow enlighten our way forward?
No, that's not how I think of it, but I do think there's a whole load of bullshit that you can make fun of that we need to make fun of.
Yes.
That's the way I think of it. I think critically, I don't think of a mystery as some kind of good that we get to. There's a big mystery weighing on us all, and that needs to be pricked. It's like this big fucking balloon, you know? Although I'm trying not to say words like that.
So we need the negative. We need to negate things in order to think.
Yes, mysteriously we need that. But I say...
Why is it mysterious to you, Bob? You're so un-Hegelian. You're such a positivist Yankee. It's unbelievable.
No, I understand now where you're coming from, Bob, because it's Manippean satire.
That's right.
You're putting on the guise of a ad man and saying, yes, mystery, you know.
And then we evoke so much learning from Ben and his vomit response. That's what's great. It helps fill up content. But Ben's on to me now. Ben, I can't do that anymore, so I got to get serious. There's a mystery we can understand, Ben.
Is there?
And,
well,
oh, yeah.
But the mystery we can understand is no longer a mystery.
That's right. Then it becomes a mystery again. How does that happen? How does the mystery continue? That's the miracle of human consciousness.
Well, there's definitely something I don't understand, which is the whole blooming thing, and therefore that's mystery enough for me, but it's not like I like it being mysterious. I mean, the more I find out about it, the more I feel happy. You know, the idea of fetishizing the mysteriousness of it is always something given to me by New Age idiots.
Yeah,
I have a question. I have a question here. Is Finnegan's Wake a hermetic work?
Exactly. Absolutely. And he remember, McLuhan wrote his thesis on alchemy, and he wrote on media alchemy starting in the mid-50s, and he was translating Joyce. See, that's what I liked about your notes, your tactility, alchemy, and whatever else you mentioned. It's all appropriate to what Ben and I are talking about.
How weird. How strange. How totally bizarre.
How mysterious. Who are
Ben,
the brave
police? How do you feel about that? Ben, how do you feel about Finnegan's Wake as a hermetic work?
I think it's an anti-hermetic work.
Diminishes it?
I think it's an anti-hermetic work because it's immediately comprehensible on the level of music. And that's the post-60s understanding of culture, which has not gone through to anybody thinking about this stuff, which is that music is a universal language, which, because it changes your body, influences you, and if you're not so repressed, you can understand what it's doing to you. And Finnegan's Wake was written to, on a musical level, so there is no secret code or set of mystical no skeleton key, no mystical set of numbers or figures or gods or goddesses or whatever you might choose to use to interpret it. The point is it entertaining to say those words on your tongue? And my assertion would be it is. And that reduction of what culture is to yourself and your tongue and what you can mouth is the anti-cultural moment of Dada, which has been ironed out of consciousness by structuralism. We're not allowed to think it anymore. The idea that immediacy and fun and might be the most interesting moment in this program for everybody. That moment is all the way through Finnegan's Wake. It's a textbook of having that. I'll go and get it, but every line that I could read from it is going to stimulate that music and that immediacy. And so it's an anti-hermetic text. He might have used various elements that people developed under the aegis of secret codes to do all this, because a lot of people have, you know, they're quite sneaky about getting this infantile stuff across in various areas.
Ben, let me respond brilliantly to this. I'm sorry, we got to go back to McLuhan.
I'm sure you'll respond brilliantly to this, Bob.
It's a brilliant response. I'm predicting it, and this will teach you something you do not know. What you just said is exactly correct, but it's only a half-truth. There's the other half. But listen to this. McLuhan, 1968. Joyce was not only the greatest behavioral engineer who ever lived, he was one of the funniest men, rearranging the most commonplace items to produce hilarity and insight. And he gives the quote, "Where the hand of man never set foot." Then he says this astounding fact. In The Code Breakers by David Kahn, David Kahn reveals a key item that seems to have eluded Joyce scholars. It concerns J.F. Byrne, B-Y-R-N-E, the Cranley of The Portrait of the Artist Young Man. The author, Byrne, is a key person in Joyce's youth. He is the author of Silent Years, a lifelong friend of Joyce. Cranley lived all his mature life, Cranley being J.F. Byrne, at the address of Leopold Bloom, 7 Eccles Street, Dublin. Who is this guy, Byrne? What did he do? Byrne spent his mature life in devising a cryptograph that would confer, quote, "the gift of perfect security upon the communications of all nations and all men," unquote. He tried to sell this to the Pentagon, or what the ministry was called, Ministry of War in the 30s.
The Pentagon said, "We're not interested in peace for all
no,
men."
No. Listen to this. You're going to have to listen to this for a minute. So Kahn
reported, only 1 minute, because we're nearing the end of the show, Bob, so you got to squash
it
in.
This is a brilliant ending. David Kahn in The Code Breakers reports, quote, "It required nothing more, this device that Cranley or Leopold Bloom invented. It required nothing more than a cigar box and a few bits of string and odds and ends for its operation," end of quote. On page 135, McLuhan points out, Joyce describes his own verbal method, which is an exact parallel of Burns, quote,
can be built with glue and clipping, scrawled or voided on a buttress. The Night Express sings his story, the song of sparrow notes on a stave of wires, unquote. And Joyce says, for anyone discouraged by Joyce's method, let him consider that it's no more than the habit of penetrating the mosaic forms of every environment, linguistic or geographic.
Bob,
what do you think of that fact?
Bob, that's how it is. This is how to create. I mean, I do it all the time. Do you? Ain't this boogie a mess? Thanks, Michael and Bob. That's the end of the show.